It is Saturday, August 2nd, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, a discussion with author David Weber.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our program, we have science fiction author David Weber. We're going to be talking about his multiple universes that he creates in his books, and about science fiction, and a whole bunch of other things. It should be a fun show. During the second half, we're going to invite you to take your opinions on air. Just give us a call during the second half to talk about science fiction and David Weber's work. That'd be great. The phone number is 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, and I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Senior Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Morning, Sean.
Good morning.
Miles is not here. Ryder Brooks, Support Engineer at Sun Microsystems. Good morning.
Good morning.
We do have David Weber. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
If you'd like to participate in our discussion about the news for the first 15 minutes, please feel free, David. We'd love your opinions. And Rick Kleffel, thank you very much for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, so, Rick Kleffel of the Agony Column.
That's yes.
Right. Trashotron.com/agony. Yes.
Sean, I think I'll start the geek news with you.
Is that good? Yeah. So Windows Vista is, we've been talking about, if you should upgrade or not. And if you do, which version do you go with? And I've always recommended Vista 64, just because almost every version except the lowest version, the cheapest, actually comes with both versions on the disk.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, why install 32-bit when you can go with 64? Well, 64-bit got a really bad rap with XP. Some reason, it just never got the uptick. Nobody built drivers. A lot of companies didn't add the support that they were adding for 32-bit. 264-bit, and there were driver instabilities and issues.
Sure.
And they just didn't get ironed out. It still has problems. I would not install XP64.
But Vista's a totally different story.
Vista's a different story, yeah. I think Microsoft realized what had gone wrong with XP, and they really put a lot of effort into getting support from companies for both versions of 32 and 64. And working at NVIDIA, I know for a fact that we optimize the 64-bit drivers just as much as we do 32-bit.
Yeah. And, of course, with 64, right off the bat, you get to put more memory in the system.
Yeah, well, that's the big key. 64-bit's not going to give you any performance just by itself. But the fact that you can address more than 2 gigabytes of memory certainly makes
major
a difference, depending on the type of applications you're running.
Well, and even with that, even with simple applications, if you're running multiples, switching between them is going to be a lot easier if you have more memory.
So we'll put the link up, but there's been some tracking of 64-bit through Windows Update, and they've actually seen 20% of new Vista PCs in the U.S. Connecting to Windows Update are 64-bit, and that number's been...
What percentage?
I'm sorry, it's been growing by 20%.
Interesting.
More people are taking advantage of memory, I think, because it's just so cheap right now.
Right.
You can buy 4 gigs of DDR2 memory for under $100.
Wow. Now, how do you know if you've got a 64-bit processor that can handle it?
All processors being sold right now are pretty much 64.
So if you're getting a new machine, definitely.
Yeah. So any Core 2 processor is 64-bit, and any Phenom, even Athlon 64, processor is 64-bit. So you're good to go that way.
All right.
So you're saying there's no advantage other than addressed memory space to 64-bit?
I don't think so.
Because when they jumped to 16-bit architecture to 32-bit architecture, there was a performance increase with calculation. So I think it's partly the programmers when they're compiling these applications for 64-bit support to take advantage of that extra.
We have a perf lab that runs so many numbers, and I've seen comparisons between 32 and 64, and I can't think of anywhere where one is better than the other. basic performance.
Yeah, I just kind of wonder, because I mean, you're limited to what, 3 or 4 gigabytes with 32-bit architecture.
And I got to say that 8 gigs of memory doesn't get you much performance over 4 gig. Yeah. So somewhere between 3 and 4 gig is the sweet spot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know with Linux, I've tried using 64-bit desktop stuff and as a desktop, you run into lots of problems on Linux because you're running typically with the Ubuntu distribution. They give you a 64-bit version of Firefox, and you just have a heck of a time running
Java,
lots of other plugins. They just there's a hard time being with compatibility between 32-bit extensions and plugins. So it's interesting to see that it's taken up on XP.
Yeah,
clearly they've got.
Sean, you were having trouble with Firefox and Flash. Was that due to 64-bit problems? Do you think?
Yeah, I think it's Firefox 64-bit version.
Right. So some of those vendors are not providing it.
Yeah.
By the way, I think you should try, what's the other, not Firefox, but Opera. You should give that a shot, see if it's better in 64-bit Vista. All right, let's go on to the next news item, Mr. Writer.
Okay.
Mr. Brooks.
Interesting blog item popped up the other day on Dan's Data. He talked a bit about how your laptop and your cell phones are basically lying to you with your battery meters and your cell phone. Signal indications.
Okay. What do you mean lying to you?
Well, some of it's marketing, at least that's his take on it, is that, so your battery meter, for instance, is, I know on my cell phone, if I plug my cell phone in for 10 minutes, all of a sudden my battery meter reads like 90-100% for about 15 minutes, and then it like conks down to nothing.
Sure.
You know, that's probably frustrating for a lot of people. He says that's mostly controlled by software. I mean, the intelligence and the power is in these cell phones to be able to accurately reflect battery life, yet they don't. And part of that is considered to be marketing. You know, a cell phone that reports, 90% battery life for, 80% of your, usage of your phone and then conks down to nothing, that's going to, be perceived as a cell phone that is more battery efficient, and you'd want to buy that.
Right.
And same with signal life. There's apparently no standard for, what how many bars represents on your cell phone.
Sure.
So you could have like a full signal, but that may only represent like half of the capacity of your signal.
Right,
So there's no standard there.
Yeah, how much power are they putting behind their, transmitter built into the cell phone? Maybe it's only picking up a small percentage of the signal, but that's a lot for that cell phone, so it's got full bars.
Yeah.
Right.
And, this was of interest to me because I moved to this new place and I get like no signal, but, I get like 3 or 4 bars, and then I turn on the phone and it drops down to nothing, right? And when I'm actually talking, it was like no signal. And apparently there's really no correlation between the quality of your phone and what your cell phone could, you could have 5 signals but still have a really bad cell phone connection. And the article discusses a lot about noise ratios. And so you have signal strength, which is typically what your cell phone's gonna read from the cell towers.
Mm-hmm.
But there's really no reflection on most cell phones of the actual quality of the connection. So you could have a lot of ambient noise, and they make an analogy of like basically talking to your friend, through a megaphone versus talking to your friend through a megaphone during the middle of a rock concert. Background noise. So you'll find actually your connection might be more accurate when you've actually initiated a call or your phone's ringing and you have a bidirectional communication with your cell provider. And, some cell phones will actually give you a more accurate reading once you've connected. But, you could have 5 bars and that would sort of explain the background noise that you get or interference from other connections would explain why you have 3-4 bars, but your phone keeps dropping or you have really bad cell phone quality. So, those things they can actually be controlled by the firmware, and a lot of these firmwares are customized by the cell phone provider, with these package deals. So they're mucking with the firmware in what it's capable of doing.
It seems to me like a Consumer Report type of group could come up with a standard to apply to and then have cell phones sign into that and advertise that standard.
You would. It's sort of a momentum that's been put in place, though. I mean, you've got this perception that these cell phones have great battery life and great signal. So if you say you were a manufacturer, why would you really want to buy into that honesty factor? Because all of a sudden you're going to be perceived as being a cruddy battery life and a cruddy signal manufacturer. So.
Well, thank you, Ryder, for that kind of depressing news about cell phone companies doing poor jobs at serving us. In the air room is Ryder Brook, Sean Cleveland, Rick Kleffel, and David Weber. I'm Lyle Troxell. We now are going to... We're going to go into our interview with David and talk to David Weber about his books, but we will be covering more news as we feel it's appropriate. David Weber is an American science fiction and fantasy author. In his stories, he creates a consistent and rationally explained technology and society, even if ours is not that rational. When dealing with fantasy themes, and the magical powers are even treated like other technology with supporting rational laws and principles. Many of his stories have military, particularly naval themes, and fit into the military science fiction genre. He challenges current gender roles in the military by assuming that a gender-neutral military service will exist in the future, and frequently placing female leading characters in what have previously been seen as traditional male roles. And, of course, his most popular character in that fits that very well is Honor Arrington, who is... I believe, and correct me, David, if I'm wrong, is an homage to Foster's character in Hornblower. Is that true?
She's actually based more directly on Horatio Nelson, who, of course, was the template for Hornblower as well. But when I decided to create the series, I knew if it worked that Hornblower was what it was going to be compared to. And I always loved Forster's books myself. So... since I had decided that her first name was going to be Honor,
and
I was
did Master
looking
Commander
for something that would be a little, you know, euphonious here, I went with Honor Harrington, and it worked. To some extent, there's an homage element in it, but Honor is definitely... Hornblower never really rose above the rank of captain or commodore during his active service during the war.
Sure.
And I always intended that Honor was not going to be Jim Kirk, who would be perpetually commanding a starship. So she was going to get promoted eventually. So from the very beginning, I had assumed that this was someone who was going to rise to the pinnacle of command, unlike Hornblower.
And the Honorverse, as it's now known as, like 13 or 14 novels more on the way, and of course shared anthologies too.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are 11 what I think of as mainstem novels that are all directly about Honor. Then there are two side novels, Shadow Saganami and Crown of Slaves. Crown of Slaves is a collaboration with Eric Flint. Eric and I have done several collaboratives. We work well together. And then there are, I think it's 5 volumes of short fiction. Which I invite other writers to come play at my house. And I've incorporated several characters from their short fiction into the ongoing storyline.
Let me let's talk about your new series. Okay. I'm saying new series. I guess Off... how long has this been out?
Off Armageddon Reef came out, I think, January a year ago.
Yeah, so it's a pretty new series. Yeah. And I just finished By Schism Rent Asunder, and wonderful. And, of course, the one thing about series is that when you finish the last book, you want the next one really quick. So how long do I have to wait till the next one?
Well, the next one's already been handed in. I was about 2 months late with Schism Rent Asunder, and I was about 9 months early with By Heresy's Distress, because book 2 grew and turned into book 2 and book 3. I was trying to figure out, how in the world am I going to get this down? And I said, wait. Okay, I have the answer.
You have two books?
Yes. So that's basically what happened. Originally, By Heresy's Distress was scheduled for March of 2009. That's been moved back a couple of months. I don't know exactly how many yet, because I have a new Honorverse book coming out in March as well, and Bane Books, my other publisher, and Tor
both
want them competing sure, with sure. each other.
Now, I don't want to ruin these books for anybody, but I think... It's pretty interesting basis that Armageddon Reef has in this idea that it's a futuristic human race that has pretty much been decimated by an alien race, and there's only a little bit of people that can survive, and technology attracts the alien race, and what structures and what conflicts start creating by having to hide what I think of as a general trait of humanity is to learn and grow and improve their technology. So that's kind of what you're addressing here, but also, of course, very powerful people feeling that their way is the best way.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a lot of ways, what these books are about is freedom of choice, freedom of will, the human spirit of questioning and of inquiry, the question of where the right to compel belief and behavior is drawn.
Mm-hmm.
From the outset, they have a situation in which there is an actual, genuine, necessary imperative to suppress advanced technology for at least a period of several centuries. The problem is that the folks who are in charge of making that decision decide that the solution is to suppress technology forever. And so they create a religion.
Mm-hmm.
And in effect, my 8 million colonists are brainwashed while they're in suspended animation to believe that the instant they open their eyes on their new homeworld is the day of creation, that the entire world came into existence at that instant.
And when you say a new religion, it so much mirrors the Catholic Church that it's hard to say. I mean, it's definitely a new religion because there isn't some of the lead characters mm-hmm. that you see in Catholicism, but it definitely has those that language.
Well, the Roman Catholic Church was taken by the folks who created the religion as their model because of the hierarchical structure,
mm-hmm.
And the institution was copied. The religion was not. It's as accurate to say that they're the Roman Catholic Church as it would be to say that Heinrich Himmler's SS was, because Himmler admired many things about the way
sure.
that the church had been. But I don't think that the church would have been real fond of Himmler's basic philosophy. The same thing is true here. This should not be in any way the church on this planet should not be confused with Christianity.
Well, it's not Christianity. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty clearly not.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, though, the history of our society of having the Catholic Church and having the delay of scientific growth because of the Catholic Church's dogma, that does impact our society by, I would say, 1,000 years of restricted knowledge.
It still does.
It still does to some degree. I think science is kind of in the lead right now. But so there is some similarities. And it makes sense that if you're going to try to create a society that doesn't grow technically to have a very rigid religious belief structure behind
it. Well, if you want to look at it that way, there's prior to the 19th century, maybe the late 18th century, ideologies were essentially religious in nature. Okay,
mm-hmm.
We really didn't have secular ideologies per se in the Western world until the Enlightenment had a chance to come along and get its feet under it. So religion was both the negative ideology and the positive ideology.
It was all of everything.
It was
all
everything.
Logic, right?
And we see this right now when we look at the Islamic world. That essentially religion and ideology are indistinguishable from one another, and they're the great motivating force of that society. Many of the thinkers of the Enlightenment who were pushing the scientific revolution were themselves deeply religious people, and some elements of the church were very progressive all the way through. By the same token, the Catholic Church per se was certainly not the only barrier. One of the problems they're going to run into eventually on Safehold is they have the written memories of 8 million literate colonists to all demonstrate
right.
that the world began at 8:14 in the afternoon on this day.
And how can you argue with 8 million people?
Exactly. There is no historical record to argue with them.
Right.
An archaeologist would find only evidence supporting what they have written.
Right, because there was no human society right. before that creation.
So there. When it comes to the debate over whether you have a Ptolemaic or a Copernican universe or that kind of thing, the problem they're going to have on Safehold is going to be that we know because of this indisputable evidence what happened. Therefore, anything that purports to prove otherwise must be the work of the devil.
Right.
Which was not necessarily the view of the church in our own experience.
Right. And as lenient leaders of the church, they started taking on the responsibility of saying, well, we will change some of our ideas. We will allow the sun to be the center instead of the earth and so on.
Some of the foremost astronomers of the period of Galileo, for mm-hmm. example, people who agreed with him 100%, were also members of the Catholic clergy.
Right.
So it's you know, we have a historical view of what religion does and doesn't do. I'm a historian by training.
You can tell.
and I'm also a Methodist lay speaker. Okay, but as a historian, you have to be aware of the negative impact that religion has often had and how it can be used to do that.
Right.
When you're talking about someone's belief in God and the condition of his soul, you have got an incredibly powerful motivator. You have one that lets someone say, well, I'm doing this for the good of your soul, so whatever I do to you must be justified. It tends to come down to very, very basic, powerful conflicts. That's one of the reasons I chose this format for the book.
We are speaking with David Weber. His books are Off Armageddon Reef and By Schism Rent Asunder, the books that we're talking about that have to do with this topic that we have. But you have a lot of other books. And this is, I would classify these as science fiction, fantasy, kind of pretty closely connected, especially By Schism Rent Asunder. There's a lot of fantasy aspects and world building. And
well, I wanted sort of that last Defender of Elfland feeling to it. And that's really who Nimue Albin / Merlin is. I mean, she's a 27-year-old naval officer who's killed and then who wakes up 800 years later with her personality and her memories, you know, uploaded to an android for all intents and purposes.
Well, we're going to be taking calls and such in just a minute. I'm going to ask people to call about this topic at hand. But let me ask you first, you're pretty well known for creating scientifically valid universes. Let's talk about the Harrington universe where you have space travel and how space travel works. Can you kind of describe that technically? You know.
Okay, well, I try not to step on the physics too hard in my handwavium. Larry Niven, I think it was, once pointed out that there is a very useful isotope. There's a very useful element. And with the right isotope of polonium, you can accomplish anything in science
fiction.
That's
a great quote, yeah.
So what I've done, my polonium, if you will, is to assume that we can engineer gravity to order. And all sorts of interesting, fun things start from there. I had a fascinating discussion with a NASA physicist, and I said, you know, I was like, oh, what are you going to tell me about? And he said, actually, I don't have a problem with it. And I said, excuse me? And he said, well, we right this minute know a little bit more about gravity than Ben Franklin knew about electricity.
Right.
And look where we are today. He said, you know, assuming that, you know, there are some huge, you know, assumptions in what you're doing. But assuming, he says, I don't know where we're going to go with it.
Well, we're about to find out a lot more about gravity with the CERN project coming online. So it's possible we'll learn to manipulate in the future. And it is interesting, with just that one little element, you're able to create a whole space-varying possibility. And let's get into that more in just a minute. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary, public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. We're speaking with science fiction and fantasy author David Weber, and you're welcome to ask us questions about his universes and his working, his writing, and personal questions if you want, though he might not answer them. The phone numbers are 476-2800, again, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Dr. Don Motika, announcing OptimageHealth.com in Santa Cruz, providing personalized solutions to health concerns by combining conventional medicine with a wide array of functional medicine techniques. Details at OptimageHealth.com. OptimageHealth.com. That's OPTImage. health.com.
Okay. Thank you, Sean.
Yeah.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. That was Sean Cleveland. We also have Rick Kleffel is here in the air room.
Yes.
We have Ryder Brooks. Our guest is David Weber. And Rick Kleffel is waiting to take your calls with questions and comments about the topic at hand. The phone numbers to do that is 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP.
Now, David, this is Rick Kleffel speaking. I wanted to ask you about a certain kind aspect of your books that I think makes them really superior to a lot of space opera that we see on the screen and on TV.
That sounds good.
There's this, but I'm going to take this back to a scene from a movie that everybody knows. It's a scene in the first Indiana Jones movie. He's standing there. He's facing a man who's waving a sword so fast you can barely see it. And he's just got this whip, and he's going, what am I going to do? And he just takes out a pistol and blows the guy away. Now, I think this is there's an analogy as to what you do in your work here, where there's always a level of technology that can just slot right above what we perceive as to be the biggest and best thing. And I think that's kind of what you do with your work.
Well, I think that I operate on the theory that threat draws forth response, and that you are going to be looking at competing technologies. Not just in the Honorverse, basically, I assumed that technology had plateaued for several centuries. And I did that in part because of the deliberate model that I was pursuing, which a historical model, which was the Nelson model and so forth. And I created a situation in which you had broadside exchanges between capital ships, you know, and all the rest of it. And what I'm doing now is you're seeing the introduction of new technologies. You're really moving into the equivalent of the dreadnought revolution and so forth. The problem that a lot of people have when they create universes for fiction is first, geographically, for example, in fantasy universe, they create a country the size of Connecticut. it has the same climate everywhere. It has one major political philosophy. It has, you know, the economy works one same way everywhere. When I decide to build a fantasy world, I try to create one where you're going to have different political systems and people who don't like each other. For example, in my fantasy universe, the half-elves are the nasty racists who look down on everybody else, and the dwarves run the superpower. You know, dwarves always get, you should pardon the expression, the short end of the stick, you know. But in this case, they get the big empire. Well, in the technology that I use and in the competing military systems, I assume that neither side is there to lose. And that therefore...
Good assumption.
Therefore, when one of them perceives that the other one has an advantage, they work to overcome it. Mm-hmm. And for example, in the case of Manticore, they have this huge numerical disadvantage. So they know that they need a tech edge if they're going to survive the oncoming war. And then when the Republic of Haven finds out that it's getting its clock cleaned by the Manticorans because of their technological superiority, instead of all sitting there and saying, oh no, we're doomed, we have people who say, well, how do we solve the problem? How do we catch up? So from the beginning, when I structured this universe, I had several levels of technology I was planning to introduce. I knew where I was going to go to, you know, this was going to be the next advantage and that was going to be the next advantage. But at the same time, I'm willing to let the books take me where the logical consequences of what I've done go. And sometimes that's not where I thought I was headed. One thing that I've always hated in science fiction is, all right, I've now painted my character into a corner. It's an inescapable trap. Fortunately, I have God weapon number 17 here that nobody mentioned to yes. you ahead of time. In one of my other series, I knew when I started the first book that somewhere in the course of the second book, I was going to cause a sun to go nova and destroy a million enemy starships. And I said,
hard to plan for that one.
Yeah, well, basically, in the very first couple of paragraphs of the first chapter of the first book, I mentioned the fact that if the particular star drive that these people use had malfunctioned closer into the star, it might have caused it to go nova. you know. And then when I needed them to go Nova, I said, well, we have these 12 starships that are going to kick their drives in inside the danger zone to provoke the Nova. But I'd established it right there in book one. You have to play fair with the reader.
I agree. I can't stand it when you get sideswept. It's one of the things that mysteries are always cut that line for me, where if you haven't told me a little bit that this is a possibility, you can't slap it upon me as a reader.
Yeah, you can use sleight of hand to keep somebody from looking closely at a character in a mystery, for example.
It takes a lot of skill.
But if the character is going to be crucial to the solution of the mystery, he has to be there, and what he did or she did has to be logically consistent with how the book is written. Yes, it has to fit. You have to do the same thing with your tech challenge. The other thing is you have to respect the limitations of your toolbox. When you give the characters a set of tools, you have to make them live with those tools. You can't just suddenly change the rules because, oh, darn, that didn't work. You know. So
in the Honor universe, they can manipulate gravity. How do they use that to propel themselves?
Well, the impeller drive... You have to understand that these are actually technically engineering problems here that we're talking about. I do theory. You know. The engineering is up to the guys who are actually living in the books. But essentially, the concept behind the impeller wedge is that you have two inclined planes of intense
gravity waves.
Gravity waves, which create a pocket of what you might call curdled space. And the gravity waves can be propagated through space at light speed, okay? And the ship inside the wedge can go with them, except, of course, that you would turn the entire crew into anchovy paste, you know, real quickly. So the gravity wave is also used as sort of an inertial sump through the compensator that they've got, the inertial compensators on board. And the actual acceleration rate that you can maintain is a factor of the efficiency curve of your inertial compensator, which is affected by the mass of the vessel.
So you don't turn the crew into paste.
Into anchovy paste, that's right. Also so that, I mean, you know, I'm allowing gravitational levels, acceleration levels here in theory, that probably are at the point where it would be impossible to maintain atomic integrity for most forces. I mean, in theory, you can accelerate it like 150,000 gravities, you know, and I hate to think.
What happens to water at that?
But the other interesting side of it is that the gravity waves then become a primary defense for the ship because there are very few weapons and destructive forces that are going to be able to get through a band that's maybe 10 meters deep, in which the gravity differential goes from free fall to 190,000 gravities. You know, it's just, I hate to think what that would do to like beam focus something like
that. It's all gone.
Now, the other thing.
So, well, because of that ability for the ship to have a momentum system, which also is a shield system, you have that traditional Navy navigation type of feel where you have to angle your ship correctly based off of who you're attacking to be able to get your guns to bear, missiles to bear, and also to protect yourself from their incoming missiles.
So and you just don't stop in space.
Right?
Exactly.
There's a lot of strategy.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is that this is not visual range combat, okay? We were talking before the show. You know, in Star Trek, you have these weapons that, in theory, can target somebody at 500 million kilometers. And somehow we're always in visual range, firing phasers and photons at each other.
Right.
And I realize that's a dramatic constraint. I love the Stargate series. But it's like I told Sharon, I said, boy, I wish I could get some of that C4. With enough of their C4, you can blow up a starship, you know. And she says, it's a dramatic convention, David. Shut up and watch the program. And I'm like, yes, dear. But it's like, you know, obviously this is antimatter C4 that they're using. And I just decided when I got started in this, I'm a military historian, political historian by training. I just decided that I was not going to subordinate the ranges the ranges that are implicit in the technology the ships have to, well, this is cooler.
Right.
Okay. And I think that's part of what you were talking about earlier about trying to be consistent in the technology.
Yeah.
And even if you make a mistake in the technology, you then have to be consistent within terms of the mistake.
Have you made a mistake?
Here and there. Here and there. We won't go into what they were. But there are also some points where people I tell people, because it happens to be true, that no one has ever read a single book I've written. Instead, everyone has read the books that I've written through the prism of their own experience, their own knowledge base, their own attitudes and views. And sometimes this means that people have pointed out things to me that I didn't realize that I'd done, that looking back, I realize I did do. But it also means sometimes that people leap to assumptions about what I'm saying about mm-hmm. technology. For example, there's a debate going on Bain's Bar at Bain.com, which is the Bain Books website. There's been references to the fact that there appears to be no AI in the Honorverse. There is no self-aware AI in the Honorverse. And I did that deliberately because I have self-aware machine intelligences in other books. But there's a heck of a lot of AI. You can't run a ship this size without
it. So it's implicit. You don't even talk about
That's right.
because it doesn't have a personality.
It would be kind of like a novelist writing about the 21st century talking about a book as a piece of technology.
Right.
Okay? Because for somebody from, say, the 14th century, a book today with moving type and all the rest of it would be an advanced piece sure. of technology.
Especially about the way they can be reproduced.
Exactly. But for these guys running around in the Honorverse, the AI, it's just there.
Right.
Okay? They don't talk about it any more than we'd be talking about Windows.
Well,
we talk about Windows a lot, but not
especially
always,
on GeekSpeak.
Yes,
let me tell you more than we want to. So speaking of the Baron's Bar, Wyvern, the chat name is actually Robert from Monterey asks us offline, when is the next Honor Arrington book going to be available, and will it be a war with the Salarian Federation?
I wonder if I want to answer that. Okay, first of all, the next Honorverse book is scheduled for release in March of 2009. It is technically a sequel to Shadow of Saganami, but actually what's happening at this point is that from here on out, the storyline is getting complicated enough that I'm going to be sort of advancing on a broad front. In theory, there are three separate Honorverse series. There's the Crown of Slaves series I'm doing with Eric Flint. There's the Shadow of Saganami series, which is a solo but was starting off to one side. And then there's the Mainstem novels. Well, what's happening now is you can think of it as a three-part novel.
You're tying them all together in this next book?
The first three chapters of Shadow of Saganami, for example, are essentially dealing with something that already happened, and at all costs, you know what happened, but you're seeing it from the perspective of a different character, who then becomes an important viewpoint character. There's going to be one chapter that appeared in At All Costs will probably appear totally unchanged in the sequel to Crown of Slaves. This does a couple of things. One is, in the case of the Shadow of Saganami, it allows me to take a character and put you behind that character's eyes in a different way. The other thing that it does is that it nails down the temporal sequence for the events that are going on in these three books. The problem is that the events in question are taking place weeks of travel mm-hmm. from one another. And so rather than trying to do them all simultaneously or trying to do them all in one book and putting in a lot of backstory to tell you, well, this happened over there, you know, off screen, what I can do is I can actually have the events transpire.
Right.
And then I'm just going to assume that the reader knows what happened in the earlier books.
Mm-hmm. I think you do that a bit in By Schism Rent Asunder, too. I mean, it's a pretty common thing in a series to kind of say, you got to know a little bit. And even if you don't, you can get through it, but it'll be more enlightening if you read the rest of the series.
Well, what's happening here, though, is that it's not a direct linear progression from At All Costs to Mission of Honor, which mm-hmm. is going to be the next Mainstem Honor novel. You have to kind of jump over to the side and do the two Shadow Saganami sequel and Crown of Slaves sequel before you can actually do the next one. I'm not sure if someone has done it this way before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because this really is, it's almost like a three-part novel. You could, you know, instead of having 30 chapters in the book, you have 90, you know, for a single bite of the storyline.
So you're not going to mention whether it's a Salarian Federation war, but you can you assure that Robert will be and will enjoy the book?
I think so.
Or Wyvern. Okay,
yeah,
good.
I think so.
So Alex wanted to Alex supports us via chat from down south, and he suggested that your AI in these ships are more like ABS in a car, where it's not aware, but it's doing smart things.
Exactly, exactly. That's a very good analogy.
And you could even use Deep Blue or whatever the AI that plays chess, right? It's very good at a strategic thing, but it doesn't mean self-aware. It doesn't mean you can have a conversation with it,
and it doesn't mean
or
that it cares,
or you want to.
But it doesn't care. Okay,
yeah.
I mean, it's just would dispassionately sit there and watch the missiles come in and destroy it if somebody didn't tell it that it was supposed to stop them, and that's.
That is a good point. That's where you actually do talk about intelligent computers,
mm-hmm.
is the AI that's just dealing with oncoming threats.
Mm-hmm. Well, when the unexpected missile attack comes in and there's nobody, there's nobody on watch. You know, the computers are okay. We know we're supposed to keep the ship from being destroyed, so we will do our best. We will do better with human input. But, you know, and when you have one of my tactical officers who's modifying attack profiles on the fly for missiles that have a range of like 3 light minutes, okay, I think you have to assume that there's some pretty impressive AI support in what that person is doing for him to be in the loop and affecting things at all.
Yeah. And something else that happens, if you think about space, you're flying at vast, really fast speeds in a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're coming at a threat, you know, let's say you actually want to attack a ship, if they make a small move at any point in time, if they're able to do that, your vectors are off, and you're not going to come into contact with that ship.
Yeah.
And the speed you're coming at each other, you know, you talk about there's an open window for mm-hmm. a very short period of time, and that's the fight.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that I work out the vectors and the accelerations and whatnot. So I know what their bubbles are, and when their bubbles impact on each other, their reach of their weapons and whatnot.
Right. Yeah. You're very detailed with this information. I mean,
how
do you figure this out? I want to know these, because you get into the details of these vectors and the headings and the speeds and, you know, the bubble, and I just mm-hmm. find it really incredible that you put this much information into a book.
On rare occasions, I have decided where I need to be at the end of the battle and then worked my way back to be sure that I
got
there.
Good strategy.
You know, if you decide, well, I want the climactic moment to be, for example, from Honor of the Queen, where the two ships are closing into their lethal range and they've hammered each other, and, you know, and Honor is taking her ship in knowing that it's going to be destroyed, but thinking she may be able to do enough damage to save the planet behind her, mm-hmm. sort of thing. I knew how I needed that final sequence to work out. And so I went back and sort of plotted the battle in reverse for where I needed it to be.
It's interesting because, of course, in that you create potentially intuition to work for Honor to mm-hmm. go through. Not that she can logically figure it out, but because of the circumstances that are going to come about, she'll wind up winning. And that is a big part of a character that's a hero and amazing, is that they have something more than just a logic path.
Well, they have something more than a logic path. They have the author on their side.
Well, that always helps.
David, I want to interject this because we're talking about Honor Harrington mm-hmm. here.
Yeah.
And that name says something. And you're a lay minister for the Methodist mm-hmm. Church. Could you talk about developing the morals for these future societies? I mean, in the 20th century, we have a certain set of morals that are pretty different from mm-hmm. what happened 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you design morals for the next century?
Well, I think that it helps to be a historian, okay, because you then have a feel for how morals shift and change. The thing is that the primary difference between where we are right now and where humanity has been at most times in its past is the degree of relativism that's crept into our moral structure. The notion that there is no absolute right, there is no objective standard of right or wrong. There is not a standard that all of us should recognize as this is what the big kahuna laid out and the way we're supposed to do it. There are many enormous strengths to that sort of a perspective. There are also enormous weaknesses. And that's true of any moral and philosophical system at any given time in its history. What I've done in the Honorverse, for example, is I have assumed that with the diaspora of humanity, different philosophical and moral paths can be followed in different societies within what is, in effect, a pluralistic galactic society that sort of allows all of them space. So I have Beowulf, which is sort of U.S. Western world taken to its logical progression. I have Grayson, which was founded by religious fundamentalist lunatics who believed technology was the work of the devil, so they bought a starship to get away from it. Okay, and then found themselves marooned on a planet where they couldn't abandon technology and survive. How do you react to that, right, that situation? So, in essence, the morals, the philosophical imperatives grow out of the situations that I put the characters in. The morals of my protagonists actually are very much of a pattern in all of my books. If you look at them, who they are responsibility takers. They are people who don't look at a situation and say, well, there's a terrible mess, thank God it's not my responsibility to clear it up. They look at it and say, there's a mess and it has to be cleared up or people are going to get hurt. And so they start working to clear it up. They are self-motivated.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons that resonates with my readers is because of the fact that everybody perceives us as living in a period of moral relativism.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to believe, which, by the way, I think is true, they want to believe that there are people out there who are going to step up to their responsibilities, are going to discharge those responsibilities, and are going to take responsibility for their own actions as well as dealing with the problems that they have in front of them.
I think that's why it's called fiction. No,
you think
I don't
that's
know
why it's
how,
called fiction?
I don't know how a bunch of our society does that. We're speaking with David Weber. He's the author of multiple books, including the Honor Arrington series, the Arrington Universe, and his most recent books, a new series, Off Armageddon Reef, and By Schism Rent Asunder, another wonderful world that he's created and I hope to keep seeing going along. Rick, you have another question.
Your Safe Hole book has a kind of an interesting dichotomy at the heart of it.
Safe Hole, by the way, is the Armageddon Reef and Rent Asunder books. Go on.
Because it's really about two competing visions of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
One is that this idea that we're good enough, all we need to do is just till the fields, milk the cows, raise the kids, grow the grain. That's it. That's all humanity needs to do, and praise the earth, and we're good. Mm-hmm. The other is of this, you know, ever-growing technological changing race that actually is able to change its own nature at some point in time. And you create a great tension between those two. Where do you yourself fall in that dichotomy?
I have very little use for people who say, boy, have we created a bunch of problems. We better throw out technology to solve them. At science fiction conventions, I walked around for like 10 or 11 days with a ruptured appendix when I was in college, in graduate school. Without modern science, I would not be here. So somebody can usually be counted on at a science fiction convention and say, well, the problem is we should, you know, go back to all organic vegetables and whatnot. And I will say, okay, how many people out there have ever had appendicitis? And I get hands. I say, how many people have diabetes? I get hands. And by the time I've asked...
Any organ transplants in the audience?
Yeah, by the time I've gone through about 10 levels of questions, every hand in the audience is up. And I say, okay, all of you are dead without modern technology. Okay?
Right.
And they go kind of...
Not to mention the 50% more deaths from just broken bones.
Exactly.
And just simple things that we think.
Yeah, well, okay, there's I don't know how many of you may have heard of it, but there's Biltmore House, which is right above Asheville. It was built by one of the Vanderbilts. It is the largest privately owned residence in North America. It's a European chateau. The guy built it. It took years to build it. He built it as a self-supporting community, blah, 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 blah. You know, owned like 50 miles on a side of the land for it. And then he got appendicitis and died at 42.
Mm.
Okay? All right. That's the difference technology makes. Okay, he could have the money, he could do everything else, but by golly, he couldn't dodge that appendicitis bullet. Technology, to me, is an enabler, and it enables human beings to live up to their own standards. Okay, now that doesn't mean they necessarily will. But if for my judgment is, for example, that the abolition of slavery, certainly it was a moral issue, but it was also the fact that you were reaching a point at which you could no longer justify slavery as a necessary way to produce a large agrarian labor force.
Because technology came in to replace it.
Semmelweis and the brass bedstead had a huge impact on female mortality rates in childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in turn, had a huge impact on how many women there were who could go into the labor force. And then technology made more jobs available that you couldn't rule women out of on the basis of you're just not strong enough to do it. So every step that our technology advances gives us a greater ability to live up to our supposed belief in the dignity of the individual human being and the rights of the and the options of the individual human being.
And with that, I think we will finish another episode of Geek Speak. What a wonderful note to finish on. Thank you, David Weber, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You can find multiple books of David Weber's online and all over the place. His most recent books are the Safehold series, Off Armageddon Reef, and By Schism Rent Asunder. And of course, Sean, our regular geek, is very addicted to the Honor Harrington series.
Yeah. These new books, you can find more information at tor.com. And go to Bain.com for the Honor book.
And that's B-A-E-N, Bain.
Yeah. In fact, you can get free books up there.
We'll put these up on geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak on KOSP, supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS, in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, offering one appointment, crowns, and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. Broadcasting HD radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, streaming live and podcasting at kosp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. And GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks today were Sean Cleveland, Rick Kleffel, and Ryder Brooks. I'm Lyle Troxell. Our guest today was David Weber, and thank you all for participating on GeekSpeak today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here, David.
Thank you.
Talk of the Bay is your source for interviews about local arts and public affairs, as well as the national issues that hit home here on the Central Coast. The Talk of the Bay team brings you in-depth analysis and discussion, including Art Studio and the Performing Arts Calendar, Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Thanks for listening and subscribing to our Geek Speak podcast. I really appreciate your endorsement of the program by you spending time listening. Hey, I'm going to ask you for a favor, and that is twofold. One is to create a dig.com account. That's D-I-G-G.com. If you go up there and you search their podcast for Geek Speak, you'll find us, and you'll notice that our dig count is pretty low. If you create an account, you can do that and then click the dig button next to our name, and it'll get our ranking up a little higher. I'd like that so that more people can find us. And the second thing is about people finding us. If you have friends and family that do not podcast but have a computer, you can go visit them, show them what iTunes is, download it, install it for them, kind of be a geek for them, and introduce this amazing free content that's available through podcasts. I think iTunes is one of the simpler tools to use. In general, just go up there and use GeekSpeak as an example so they subscribe to GeekSpeak. That'll boost our numbers on iTunes Store, and more people will be able to find us. All right, thank you so much for that help, and I hope to see you soon next week listening to GeekSpeak. Take care.